Morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, my name is Frank Staggs, and at counsel's table is Ann Scarrow, who is the trial counsel in this case. Together, we represent the petitioners. The plaintiffs below who are the surviving family members of Eulalia Mayorga, Emma Arroyo Trejo, two friends who were killed in Mexico on October 4, 1979, while en route together from Corpus Christi, Texas, to Mexico City. The defendants, the respondents, are the two bus lines, Trailways and Transportes del Norte. This case represents in many ways a full circle from this court's 1985 decision in Downer versus Aquamarine Operators. Both cases concern discovery sanctions. In both cases, the courts of appeals overturned the trial court's discretionary actions in ruling on motions for sanctions. In Downer, the trial court found an abuse of discretion, abuse of the discovery process. In this case, the trial court did not. As much as Downer sent messages to lawyers and trial courts about sanctions, it also tried, I believe, to send a message to the courts of appeal to respect trial courts' acts of discretion in dealing with discovery matters in their own courtrooms. After Downer, the rules were strengthened and altered. Also, the way this court enforced these rules changed in dramatic ways. Some of these changes occurred by rewriting the discovery rules, but also in this court's rulings in cases such as HEB versus Morrow, E.F. Hutton, and Gutierrez. This case is before this court on a discovery ruling made in our client's favor by the trial court, Judge Robert Garza, on the issue of testimony given by a Mexican federal police investigator, Hector Lira Morales. We are here not to have Downer and its progeny overturned, but more to the point to seek a clarification of the review standards to be applied in Downer discretionary type actions. I would submit that cases like Gutierrez, E.F. Hutton, and H.E.B. versus Morrow have perhaps gone a little too far in strengthening the role of sanctions at the expense of trial court discretion. I think this is typified by the Court of Appeals statement in its opinion that, quote, the Supreme Court has made it abundantly clear that the courts will not tolerate even minor infractions of these rules.
I thought you said in your brief that plaintiffs in no way attempt to persuade the court to stray from the discovery guidelines it has previously mandated.
No, Your Honor, we're not asking you to stray. We're not asking the court to overturn these decisions. I think what we are seeking is a clarification of the standards by which the trial court's actions are judged. What constitutes abuse of discretion? What constitutes a proper exercise of discretion?
There's a question. What is good cause?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think more broadly, it's what proof is necessary, what kind of proof can the trial court base its actions on? If it's based on some proof in the record, if there's something in the record to substantiate what the trial court has done, by definition, that's not an abuse of discretion.
Is good excuse the same as good cause?
To some extent, I believe that the factors which would constitute a good excuse would also factor into to good cause.
What evidence of good cause did the trial court in this case hear before he ruled?
At the time of the hearing, Your Honor, the attorney for TDN got up and presented his case. He was arguing at that time that plaintiffs had not disclosed an expert. The judge then asked the attorney whether or not he had expert interrogatories, and the attorney responded in a negative. He said, I believe that he had interrogatories dealing with witnesses. At that point, the trial court overruled the motion. Plaintiff's attorney had not had an opportunity to build a record at that time before the trial court ruled, but in the same hearing, a couple of pages into the statement of facts, when Ms. Scarrow finally got the floor, she made her record. And I think the most dramatic part that she made was that she approached the trial bench, and the record reflects this, showed the trial court what kind of exhibit had been tendered to her back in 1981 at a deposition, where we had requested the report that's now under fire, under a subpoena deuces tecum. And at that time, the trial judge could see that it was a completely illegible copy. I believe that the copy that's in the court's record was one that was introduced at trial and is a much clearer copy.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I've gone through the records. And is the report that we're talking about in Spanish?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the bottom of the report is almost totally illegible?
Yes, Your Honor, but this is still a much clearer copy than the one that was tendered as Exhibit Number 9 at the Rodriguez deposition back in October of 81.
Although I know what's in it, was there ever an English translation of the report introduced into evidence?
During trial, there was a translator was used as the as portions of the report were read.
Okay.
And there were, when the report was finally introduced into evidence, it was done by translation, but not written down. Going back into the history of the case, Your Honor, as I said, it's a wrongful death case that occurred back in October of 79. Suit was filed in September of 1980. It was in April of 81 that the plaintiff's attorney that was handling the case at the time received two sets of interrogatories. Each set totaled over 150 interrogatories. Responses were made. Some of those interrogatories requested information about investigations of the bus wreck. At that time, plaintiffs had no access to any report from the Mexican government and responded in the negative. It was in October of that year that the plaintiffs noticed the deposition of Mr. Rodriguez, who was the representative of Transportes del Norte. In their subpoena duces tecum, they requested essentially the same information about the reports. If there was any reports, to please produce them. Those did come in. CDN did have a copy of it, and the copy that they tendered, again, was very illegible, and the judge saw that. With little to go on, the report being tendered by CDN being of no use whatsoever, Ms. Scaro eventually hired two United States investigators and also two investigators in Mexico to try and find some witnesses. At first, she was unsuccessful. She was finally successful when, in August of 17, 1986, several weeks before trial, she located Hector Lira Morales in Mexico. The next week, plaintiffs notified TDN and referred in their supplemental interrogatory answers to Exhibit Number 9 of the Rodriguez deposition. By that time, Exhibit Number 9 finally had some meaning to the plaintiffs. In point of fact, plaintiff's identification of the accident report, Rodriguez Exhibit Number 9, enabled the defendants to refer to their own legible copy. And this would be in substantial conformity to Rule 168, Paragraph 2. TDN knew what the report said. They knew what the conclusions were because they were attached to the report. TDN admitted, both defendants admitted, that they always had a copy of this report. The parties came before the trial judge a few days before trial on several pretrial matters, including the motion for sanctions that's now under attack. I would like to point out again that TDN is the only party to have served interrogatories and the only party to have filed a discovery motion. Trailways did neither. I recognize that today the court denied writ in the case of Smith versus Grizzly, which says that all parties have a right to rely on interrogatory answers. The distinction in this case would be that, at least in Smith versus Chrisley, the complaining party had made objection at the trial court, and it was on that objection that the case was appealed on. In this case, Trailways did not have an objection, did not have a motion for sanctions. Judge Garza allowed Mr. Lear's testimony in his report, but he cut out the admission of the conclusions which had been attached to his report by Mr. Lira's superiors. The conclusions laid the blame on Speed. Defendants moved for a new trial, and when they did, they re-urged the Lira matter. By this point, the record not only included the September 2 hearing where Judge Garza saw the report exhibited by Ms. Scaro, also in the record was the Rodriguez deposition with the actual exhibit attached, the Lira deposition that was on file that day and used during trial, but it also included by this time the full testimony of Hector Lira, where he was further cross-examined by defense concerning his recent discovery by the plaintiffs. Parts of that testimony was recited in our brief on motion for rehearing to the Court of Appeals, but apparently those sections, that evidence was ignored by the court. And I believe that this would be in contravention of this court's ruling in Downer that the entire record must be reviewed in support of the trial court's judgment.
So is it your position that once the trial court rules that good cause has been shown, that any evidence that it, or argument that is offered at a later time can be considered in determining whether there was, in fact, good cause?
Exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly what Downer said. This court in its 1985 ruling in Downer said that the trial court not only has the authority but the responsibility to review any pretrial interlocutory order upon proper post-trial motion, considering the entire record of the case up to and including the motion to be considered. That would be on page 241 of the Downer opinion.
How is the Court of Appeals to know whether evidence and argument submitted after the trial court ruled would have been found to be persuasive by the trial court one way or the other?
In a case like this, Your Honor, where the trial court has already made its ruling, I believe that the evidence that's in the record should be presumed to support his judgment.
There was evidence in the September 2nd, 86 hearing and later that the plaintiff did not learn of the details of the missing witness. Was there ever any testimony that the defense had been in contact with this missing police officer?
No, Your Honor. The evidence that was elicited by both the plaintiffs and the defense at his deposition and at trial basically dealt with his discovery by the Mexican investigator Sylvia Morris. He testified that he had not been contacted by the plaintiffs or any representative of the plaintiffs until I believe he testified the Sunday before the Sunday of the deposition. So that was within 2 weeks. And
I understand that, but had he been contacted by any representative of the defendant?
I don't know that, Your Honor. That was never elicited. The two main issues involved in this appeal on which writ was granted was whether the trial court erred in allowing the testimony of the investigating officer, whose report the plaintiffs did identify in supplemental response to the interrogatories 2 weeks before trial, and if so, was such error reversible error? The plaintiffs contend that the answer to either question is no, and that as a result, the 13th Court of Appeals erred in finding reversible error after making what amounts to an independent fact determination contrary to that of the trial court's good cause finding. What's not involved, at least in oral argument, are those issues such as choice of law, tariff, alter ego, and the like. With all due respect to the Court of Appeals, the facts described in its opinion do not mesh with the clear record in this case. To show this, I would respectfully refer this court to the Court of Appeals opinion on page 789, the first paragraph under the headnote 1. Each of its findings and each of its holdings is not supported by the record. Beginning with the first two sentences, where the Court of Appeals says that plaintiff's attorney presented no evidence of good cause at the sanctions hearing, but instead stood silent but for one hearsay objection, I would refer the court to volume 3, pages 6 through 28. And I would also note that the court was hearing several motions at the time. Some of the things that came out in that hearing came out after he overruled the motion for sanctions, but I believe this happened within just several minutes and should be considered in support of the trial court's ruling. And I would specifically point the court to page 14, line 20 of the hearing, where she approached the bench, and it covers about a page of the record. The court also had knowledge that by the time the motion for sanctions was presented and heard, that Mr. Lira's deposition had already been taken, and it was already on file. It had been filed at 10 o'clock that morning. I believe the court also had knowledge that the interrogatories that had been propounded upon the plaintiffs exceeded 150 questions and answers. And I believe that is one factor the court might have considered in determining whether or not the motion for sanctions was well-founded. As mentioned earlier, that evidence which the Court of Appeals failed to consider contrary to Downer showed that Mr. Lira had moved frequently about Mexico after the bus wreck and that he had been found by plaintiff's investigator just the week before the plaintiff supplemented their interrogatory responses. And the record also shows that TDN had a legible copy, and it had tendered that legible copy during the trial and also at the deposition. More important, it completely disproves Trailway's allegation in its response to our application on page 10 of their brief that Ms. Scaro had located Lira long before the deposition. The plaintiffs have set out at length quotes from the statement of facts which conclusively disprove this recurring and unfounded allegation. The defendants have apparently misconstrued our argument in this regard. We are not contending that the tender of a legible copy of Lira's report on the day of his deposition led to his discovery. That would be impossible. What the record shows happened is that despite ever having TDN's clear copy, the Mexican investigator was able to finally track down Lira in the center of Mexico, and I believe that is a completely different argument. The defendants have repeatedly thrown down a gauntlet of allegations without any reference to the record, and at every instance we have picked it up and disproved it with the record. Another misinterpretation of the record in the Court of Appeals opinion is where it incorrectly at least implies that both appellants raised the objection. The record shows that Trailways did not have a discovery request and did not have a motion for sanctions. In this regard, I would cite the court to a 1986 Beaumont case, Higginbotham versus Bemis. It's found at 722-511, which says that to grant a motion for sanctions against a party which operates in favor of a non-moving party under similar circumstances would be improper and might, in fact, offend due process. Another important issue that particular sentence in the Court of Appeals opinion brings up is its conclusion that a proper motion was in fact made and argued. I think it is significant to point out that regardless of the wording of the underlying written motion, which is found in the transcript at page 406, that was made by TDN, what TDN argued to Judge Garza was that the plaintiffs had failed to timely disclose an expert, whereupon Judge Garza asked TDN's attorney whether or not they had expert interrogatories, and he replied no. He said, I have some for witnesses. I cannot hazard to say just how minutely Judge Garza may have parsed TDN's written motion, but I would submit that if a party's attorney presents on the record an oral argument that states that his motion is brought because of an alleged failure to disclose experts, an argument that was never corrected or amended, and admits that there was no expert interrogatories as such, that the trial court ruling from the bench or reviewing a prior ruling does not commit error in denying the motion. I would like to quote the court a brief statement that was made by Justice Harlan in the case of Henry versus Mississippi in 1965 at 397 U.S. 443. A trial judge is a decision maker, not an advocate. To force him out of his proper role by requiring him to coax out the arguments and imaginatively reframe the requested remedies for counsel before him is to place upon him more responsibility than a trial judge can be expected to discharge. Going on to the subsidiary issue, that if there was error, it was reversible error. What I would like to say is that it's the way the Court of Appeals went about finding reversible error by, in fact, making a no-evidence determination on TDN's no-evidence points of error that plaintiffs' points 5, 6, and 7 are primarily directed. This court has jurisdiction to review the courts of appeal de facto rulings on TDN's points 4 and 5 in that court for two reasons. First, from the way they are argued and presented, the points are only no evidence points. Second, contrary to the Court of Appeal's finding that Lyra's testimony provided the only evidence of liability, there was the graphic testimony of one of the daughters, Gloria Trevina, who went to survey for herself the wreck site. She described the long skid marks, the abutment, the bus jump, authenticated and described pictures of the wreck site, which showed the long distance that the bus traveled as it rolled on a flat, level ground to the edge of a ravine from which it fell further. The defendants attempted to rebut the evidence of liability in this case with testimony by its witness, someone named Mr. Butters, who got on the stand and tried to convince the jury unsuccessfully that the bus was going almost at a snail's pace, slower than the average human walks when the accident occurred. He tried to explain the distance and the rolling motions by hypothesizing a complex configuration of motion. But one thing he did admit that was important was that speed would be a factor. I would also point out to the court that it's truly questionable whether TDN's point of error 5 in the Court of Appeal in any ways constituted a point of error. It does not address any error. It does not say that the trial court erred in either rendering judgment or overruling the motion for new trial. It simply states, quote, there is no evidence to support the jury's finding of excessive speed, special issue number 1, parens B, parens close. The plaintiffs are here seeking a reversal of the Court of Appeals judgment and affirmance of the trial court's judgment in their favor. The rules of appellate procedure require that before a Court of Appeals can reverse a trial court's judgment, the error complained of must have amounted to such a denial of the rights of the appellant as was calculated to cause and probably did cause the rendition of an improper judgment. Likewise, discovery sanctions are imposed to secure compliance with the discovery rules by the particular party in question, to deter other litigants from violating the rules, and as punishment. This court stated in Bodnow versus City of Honda that imposition of sanctions should further one or more of these goals. The sanction of reversal imposed by the Court of Appeals in this case does not further any of these goals of justice or facilitate in any way the administration of justice. Judge Garza's ruling concerning Mr. Lear did not offend any sense or premise of justice. It was a just ruling under the facts of this case.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals in its opinion on the next last page states that we do not reach the main points if they're not controlling. Are they factually sufficient points if they've not passed on? And
Your
if
Honor,
they are, will we not have to demand the Court of Appeals to attempt to determine the factually sufficient points?
Your Honor, I believe in order for the court to have found that there was harmful error in this case, that it would have had to make a ruling on the two evidence points that TDN raised. But in answer more specific to your question, the evidence questions that were raised by TDN in its points of error 4 and 5 raise only no evidence challenges. And that can be determined first that the argument under both points is strictly a no evidence point, claiming that there was no evidence to support the trial court's judgment or in this regard.
And the short answer is that there are no factually sufficient points.
Exactly.
The court of appeals.
Exactly right. I started out by saying that in many ways this case represents a full circle from Downer, and I think that is true. On the one hand, Downer represented a trial court's finding in the exercise of its discretion of discovery abuse and its imposition of sanctions. On the other hand, this case represents a trial court's exercise of that same discretion in finding no sanctionable abuse of the discovery process by plaintiffs. What both cases have in common is that the Court of Appeals in both cases substituted their own judgments for those of the trial courts. In both cases, there was proof in the record to support the trial court's ruling. In Downer, this court acted to affirm the trial court. We're asking this court to do the same here. Sanctions are a good thing, Your Honor, but I think that discretion in the trial court and by the trial court is an equally important aspect of our common law courts. It was important, I believe, for the court in Downer and the cases that followed it to arm the trial courts with sanctions, let them know that they were going to be upheld if they imposed them. But I think it's equally important that those trial courts ought to be given the discretion to exercise that. And that would mean on a case-by-case basis whether or not the trial court thought that the conduct of the responding party was egregious. In closing, it would be a grave injustice to allow the courts of appeals reversal to stand. The sword of sanctions has been used against the wrong party, and plaintiffs therefore pray that the court of appeals judgment be reversed and that this court render and affirm the trial court's judgment.
Counsel, let me ask you. The rule provides that the trial court may in fact find good cause for allowing a late named witness to testify. If it grants that person an opportunity to testify and it goes up on appeal on an abuse of discretion, do we review that testimony on abuse of discretion as a no evidence type of point so that all the evidence that favors the trial court's judgment is all that can be looked at?
I believe that the court can look at the whole record, but if there's something in the record, and in essence it would be somewhat of a no evidence point, I don't believe it's a factual sufficiency review, and that the appellate court weighs the evidence one way or the other. I think that there's something in the record that shows the trial court did not act capriciously for some unfounded reason, that by definition he did not abuse his discretion.
Your position on page 17 of your brief is that there was an implicit finding of good faith by the judge. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor. At the hearing on September 2, he did not come out and say, I find good cause. I believe that the cases that have followed your decisions in HEB versus Morrow and E.F. Hutton have provided that the trial court may make an implicit finding of good cause. One thing I would point out at the hearing on motion for new trial, it was the fact that the court may have found a good cause, have made a good cause finding, was discussed. I believe it's the record that shows that the court made a good cause finding. And if the facts support a good cause showing by the plaintiffs, then the trial court's judgment, its exercise of discretion in its own courtroom, ought to be upheld.
Do you take the position that they did not object at trial to the admission of Larry's testimony when offered?
At the time that it was offered, no, Your Honor.
They did not?
At least not on a discovery basis.
Not on a discovery basis. What about at trial?
At the trial. But they didn't re-urge their discovery objection. The motion
was that objection made, the discovery objection?
They filed a motion for sanctions several days before trial, and it was heard on September 2.
Before trial started?
Yes, Your Honor, just before voir dire.
Is anything analogous in this case to motions in limine?
I think that would be a very good analogy.
You don't object to the trial, you wait in what you asked for in the motion in limine?
I think that would be an excellent analogy, Your Honor. I think another reason it's important is because if the expert or the witness, whoever got on the stand, out of the presence of the jury, the opposing counsel might well take that witness on voir dire or someone else on voir dire and elicit more evidence of good cause during the testimony that precedes that witness's testimony. It may well be that they've waived it by referring to it in opening arguments, things like that. The whole record up to the time of the testimony would need to be considered, and I think that the ruling on the motion in limine would be very different.
Is there something to consider, or do you think it's pivotal?
I think it's something to consider. I don't think that it's something that the case should hinge on. If there are no other questions from the court, I would yield to opposing counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Rinaldo Garza and Mr. Thomas Black, which present arguments for the respondent.
I'm Mr. Garza, Your Honors, and I represent Transportes del Norte. This is a serious matter for them, and want to argue some questions involving conflicts of laws. Three employees of the company are here. They drove up from Mexico City, and I don't want you to think they're on a spending spree because they all stayed in the same room last night, but it is a matter of great concern to them. Some background, like in 1979, prior to that time we had Lex Loci Delecti, right? Place of the action that determines the law. Plus, we also had the forum non-convenience sort of a theory that Mexican law was so dissimilar to U.S. law, to Texas law, that Texas courts would not bother to hear accident suits arising in Mexico. Well, that changed just about the time this accident happened. So not only was the place of the accident controlling, but the courts would first, would also then say, the Texas courts say, we can hear Mexican bus accident cases. That was sort of a double whammy on these people. And so it's a serious concern to them, as certainly a judgment of this size affects them, and I don't believe that they're, you know, in making a conflict of laws decision, you have to realize that their rate schedules aren't quite set under Texas damage standards. Your Honors, in the little thing that comes out in the Texas Supreme Court Reporter, the summary of the case when you grant writ, it says in here that approximately 1 week before trial, the personal representative supplemented her answer supplying the names of witnesses. Well, this isn't a case of late supplementation. This is a case of no supplementation. They've never submitted answers to interrogatories that told me that Hector Lida Morales was a potential witness, what his oral reports to him were, what he had to say. That's never been done. The most they did is he says, I've got a witness, but I'm not going to tell you who it is, but I'll take him to your office Monday afternoon, the day before trial, which happened to be a Labor Day on Monday afternoon. And that's the first time we had any inkling who their witness was going to be or what he was going to say, because his testimony at trial was totally different from his accident report. When they refer to this exhibit number 9 to this deposition, that exhibit was about a 50-page exhibit. It contained a heck of a lot more than his one- or two-page report. So how am I supposed to divine from that this guy's going to be a witness and what his new and different testimony is going to be? You talk about getting bushwhacked at trial. I mean, I got it. I don't feel that my client got a fair trial.
Did you make this argument to the trial court?
Yes, sir. The week before trial, you know, I found out that they had a witness, a liability witness, but they wouldn't tell me who it was. So I prepared a motion for sanctions. And it was argued on Tuesday the 2nd. That was the day set for trial. And without, you know, I think the rules kind of put the burden on the person wanted to use that witness to show good cause and to have evidence of good cause and to come forward and show on the record. That's what the rule says. They didn't offer any good cause, didn't give any good cause. There was no offer to show good cause, no evidence of good cause. The judge said, I'm going to let him testify. I believe the court says, as a matter of law, that's an abuse of discretion. And I don't agree that the Downer case says that you can consider anything after the motion was heard in determining if there was good cause up front. And I don't necessarily agree that that's what Downer says. Downer says up to and including, the court can consider anything up to and including the motion. That was the language in Downer. I don't think that even afterwards they showed good cause. There's no showing in there they've been looking for this guy for a year.
You got to the hearing and didn't know who it was?
The hearing was on Tuesday morning, the 2nd of September. They revealed him and brought him to my office the afternoon before.
And you took the deposition at that time?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to clarify. I didn't understand from what you had said earlier.
Judge, that's a little late to start trying to defend against what the guy had to say, which was...
What date did the trial start?
We picked the jury the 2nd, and the guy was the first witness on the next day on the 3rd.
Without motion for continuance.
Your Honor, I pointed out in my brief that the court said there's not going to be any continuances in this case. And I believe in the Gutierrez and the HEB and those Udell cases that we don't have the obligation to accept one. I mean, I think I might have taken one had he offered it, but the judge said there's not going to be any continuances. It was the oldest case on his docket, and he wanted to move it.
This is a 50-page exhibit.
that you referred to from the prior deposition, was that the, what was that exhibit of which this was one page?
Your Honor, that was like the authorities down there sort of do an investigation when there's an accident.
Of your client?
No, the Mexican authorities, police authorities or whatever, and it was sort of their report. And that was produced at a deposition in 1981, and I point this out in my brief. They didn't ask the witness what the exhibit said, what's in it, what it concluded. They didn't complain that it was a most unusable and illegible copy. They never filed a motion for sanctions regarding that exhibit. They never complained we asked them too many interrogatories. But now they say, well, you know, you gave me a bad exhibit and you asked me too many interrogatories, so excuse me for not telling you who the witness is. But how can you excuse when someone knows who the witness is and should reveal that and answer the interrogatories and knows it and refuses to give it to you until the afternoon before trial?
Well, did that one page identify the witness?
It said that, yes, it identified the witness, but it sure didn't tell us that he was now going to blame the accident on speed instead of a mechanical failure.
So you really knew who the witness was from 1981 forward, not just from the day before this hearing?
I knew that he was, I would have known that he was the investigator, all right.
You knew it was
an investigating officer, someone had been at the scene.
You knew it was a person with knowledge of relevant facts. You just didn't know for sure he was coming to testify in this case.
I didn't know for sure. In fact, Mr. Jones and I, trial attorney for Travelers, are saying, you know, they don't have any witnesses. I mean, I don't have a burden to prove or disprove anything. They hadn't revealed any witnesses.
In his report, and help me out here because of the representation that he made a statement in his investigative report back in 81 that the accident was caused by mechanical failure.
Yes, sir.
There was an allusion made here, a reference made here, that the supervisors cut out something about the implication that left me, perhaps we were not communicating, I didn't understand. The implication was that he all along knew, wanted to say that the accident was caused by excess speed, but the supervisor didn't let him put that in the report. That was the implication.
No, sir, that's not in the record. In Exhibit 9, which they tried to supplement the record with, but which the Court of Appeals didn't let them, but that exhibit goes on to conclude, and they blame it on the dead driver, which, if you're familiar with Mexico, they usually blame it on the dead guy because that ends the case.
Is that in evidence?
No, sir. You can take judicial notice of that.
Did you use his report to impeach him at trial?
Yes, I did. They are in their brief complaining that we adopted his testimony and vouched for it. Well, if I did that, it was inadvertent, and I guarantee you I didn't do it. But we have a right to try and impeach him, especially with his report and his $5,000 expert fee. And I'm going to skip to the point of my last point of error, if I may.
Is that a rundown?
Sir, what, sir?
That he got paid $5,000?
Yes, sir. He was making $3,600 a year. He got $5,000 to come and testify. It refreshed his memory because it had all been erased from his mind, but he was able to recall that speed was the determining factor in this accident.
Is this matter to talk about in the record?
Yes, sir. That's in the record.
That's something the jury had to consider.
Yes, sir. My last point of error that I raised before the Court of Civil Appeals, and I think I brought up here by filing my brief, the worst part of the case, the most gut-wrenching part of the trial, was they had a lot of post-death treatment of the bodies, that the bodies were stinky, smelly, unrecognizable. They hadn't been embalmed, they'd been buried in the ground. They dug them up, took them home. They couldn't tell if it was their mother. One of the coffins broke open and leaked out body fluids, and there was a horrible stench. And I mean, it was, and these four daughters, there was two ladies, four daughters, I mean, they were crying, and it was really a tough part of the case. And that got them over the hump, I think. They forgot that Mr. Lita was bought and paid for. And all of that evidence, post-death treatment of the bodies is a separate tort. And it was not pled, and it was not part of this lawsuit. It was objected to, and it was let in. And that was highly prejudicial, I think, to the defendants. My third point of error also deals with the witness Lita and objections that he should not have been allowed to testify as an expert witness. He's not the equivalent, nor has he been shown to be the equivalent of a highway patrolman here. And he was allowed to testify. You see, the bus was not speeding in the sense that it was exceeding the speed limit. He says, if it had been going slower, it could have been able to stop after something broke on it or something. So he's rendering opinions as an expert, but he's really not an expert. He didn't even know how to really measure, give coefficients of speed. He says, I just chose the highest one because it gives the most speed. And that's set out in our brief. But I don't think he should have been allowed to testify as an expert witness. Certainly to allow him to testify as an expert witness was prejudicial to us. My second point of error is on the conflict of laws question. And I think this is a genuine issue for this court to consider. I believe, and I've set it out in the brief, I don't want to go over it here, but there's just so few contacts in Texas. It's unless the rule is just going to be the jurisdiction with the most damages applies, I can't believe that's going to be the conflict of law rule for this state. To impose our damage limits on an accident that happened in Mexico under these circumstances is not fair to these people. It's not like Transportes del Norte came up here and was hustling business and putting together tours and all that sort of thing. And I've set out all the things in my brief that I filed before the Court of Civil Appeals, and I filed up here as an amendment. I believe it's an important point. I'd like to point out in connection with that that there are two statutes, two rules, Your Honors. One is Rule 184A, Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And the other is Texas Rules of Evidence 203. They say the same thing, and they're the rules that deal with how do you determine foreign law. This wasn't covered in any of my briefs here, but it was down in Corpus. And both those rules state that the court in determining the law of a foreign nation may consider any material or source, whether or not submitted by a party or admissible under the rules of evidence, including but not limited to affidavits, testimony, briefs, and treatises. It seems to say is this is a question of law, and even if it's not admissible under some other rule of evidence, we want to know what the law is. The first issue then is, should Mexican law apply? The second issue is, if it should, what is that law? And we submitted affidavits, and it's in the record as to what that law is. And we think plainly under the most significant contexts which apply in this case, that Mexican law should apply.
Did you object at the time of trial to the witness testifying?
Your Honor, I did not. We had heard my motion for sanctions on the day the trial was set to start. We went in, picked the jury. He's the first witness up. I didn't re-object at the time he took the stand. And I haven't found any cases that say that I'm supposed to, nor have I think they've quoted the court any that say that. There's an appellate rule, and I mentioned it in a brief, that says that you're supposed to raise your point by objection, motion, or something else. And I raised this issue by motion. I think I complied with that appellate rule. I raised the issue by a motion.
It was a motion in limine prior to the trial?
No, sir. It was a motion for sanctions. I filed a motion for sanctions. I said, don't let anyone testify that they should have told me about in these interrogatories and haven't. So it was a motion directly related to this issue. The judge said, I'm going to let him testify.
That was a motion for sanctions filed in limine, wasn't it? Before the trial started? Before the trial started?
Yes, sir.
And yet you did not re-urge your objection when the witness was called?
When he took the stand, I didn't re-object, no, sir.
The record that I saw in the September 2nd hearing is about 4 pages long. Is that the entire record?
That's it. Your Honor, I'm cutting into my co-counsel or my other counsel's time.
Just one more thing.
Yes, sir.
There is a period of time that you say they knew they were going to call this officer as a witness and they did not tell you about it prior to the deposition. Is that right?
That's correct.
What period of time is that?
It was like midweek of the week before trial.
So we're talking about 3 or 4 days?
About 5 days. She said, no, I'll, in fact, and she referred, they referred a transcript page or statement of facts page 413. She said, writes a letter and says, I'll tell you who my witness is on Monday afternoon, then you tell me who your is on Monday afternoon, and we'll go ahead and post. Well, I never agreed to that procedure. I filed my motion for sanctions right away.
Well, I guess basically when you took the deposition of the Mexican officer, did you determine when he was first contacted by the plaintiff?
I think the record indicates about 9 days earlier.
May it please the court, I'm Thomas Black. I represent Trailways in this case. I'm not going to say very much about this, I guess, the primary issue in this case, the sanctions. I think that's been very well covered by Mr. Garza. We join in that. I would like to make two comments about it. One is the implications that Trailways should not be given the benefit of these sanctions because they did not actually file a motion. I think there are two answers to that. One is that this court has held that one of the primary purposes of these sanctions is to punish people who violate the sanctions. And that certainly would not be accomplished here if they held this witness' testimony is good against Trailways and can be used against Trailways but not against TDN. We have cited in our brief the case of Carvin's Harris County, which says pretty much that effect is out of the Houston First Court. It's on page 14 of our response. The other thing is the finding of the Court of Appeals that the suit against Trailways is just inextricably intertwined with that of TDN. It's totally no suit against Trailways. They don't even have
my client. Their theory is based upon the fact that a subsidiary, Trailways Inc., sold these decedents a bus ticket in Corpus Christi, taking them from Corpus Christi to Mexico City, and did not disclose to them at that time, and they say it at any other time, and did not disclose to them that they would be traveling from Brownsville to Mexico City on a Mexican bus line. It's kind of, although I had never heard of this undisclosed principle theory being used in a tort case before, it's certainly been used in contracts cases in many occasions. There was no allegation of negligence against Trailways and no jury finding. If you look at the jury's verdict, it's that TDN was negligent. There's no finding at all. Trailways is not even mentioned in the verdict. And I think basically our complaint in this case, although it's more complicated than this, is that we think we should have gotten to the jury on the fact issues that concerned us, and we weren't allowed to. The trial court just took two of the major fact issues that were raised in this case that involved Trailways and said, I'm going to decide these in chambers. And that's basically what happened in this case. First involves the corporate separateness or alter ego of Trailways Inc. The undisputed evidence in this case shows that the ticket that was sold by a subsidiary of Trailways, Trailways Bus Company in Corpus. This subsidiary was not made a party to this lawsuit, and there were no pleadings or anything involving it. The whole case only mentions one defendant on that standpoint, and that's Trailways Inc., the parent corporation. They were transported to Brownsville by another subsidiary, and all transactions thereafter with Trailways were with another subsidiary, Trailways Bus Systems, Inc. Now, all of this was made known to the plaintiffs early in the game. Like 2 or 3 years before the trial in this case, they took the deposition of one of the Trailways employees, and he revealed to them these facts that I just mentioned to the court. They did nothing. They sued Trailways Inc., period. They didn't make any allegations about fraud or sham or alter ego or anything else. They didn't ask for anything to go to the jury. The only thing that they had is some proof that came out at that same deposition that these subsidiaries
office in the same building, not in the same office, but in the same building as Trailways, Inc., and that, to some extent, it was not brought out that they had interlocking officers and directors. And I think that the court knows that the decisions of this court are almost unanimous. We have cited three of them, decided in the 80s, that there must be some showing of some kind and a jury finding to justify ignoring the corporate separateness and setting aside the corporate veil in the manner that was done by this district court.
And the Trailways went up here once before on that same issue?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. They may have, but I know that other corporations have been up here and other stockholders. One of the cases that I have cited to the court is Lucas versus Texas Industries, cited on page 23 of our brief. In that case, there was pleading of alter ego, there was evidence, and it was submitted to the jury, and there was a jury finding that the parent corporation, the Texas Structural Products, no, the parent corporation was the alter ego of the subsidiary. That evidence was, as recited in the court's opinion, that they were all of the same directors or officers, that they had filed consolidated income tax returns, and that they shared the same corporate logo. And the jury found alter ego, and this court didn't send it back remanded or anything. This court rendered judgment for the parent corporation on the grounds that that proof apparently was no proof at all justifying. The second case, the other case, well, the third case we cited is Castleberry against Branscom. So that's a 1986 opinion of this court on page 24 of our response. In that case, a lot of the opinion in that case is taken up with approving the instruction given by the trial court and in statements in the Court of Appeals, but that was a 5-4 decision of this court, and the one thing that this court agreed on was that these are matters that, one, that are the burden of proof of the party wanting to set aside the corporate veil, and two, that it should go to the jury. These are jury matters. And they've not pled, proved, or submitted an issue to the jury on this. We're here on a court's a fiat.
In that regard, Castleberry has some rather, not harsh language, but it undercuts Lucas quite a bit.
That's right, Your Honor. But it still says that the jury should be the one to decide.
Well, the facts in Lucas were such that it really was a jury issue.
I understand that, Your Honor.
I'm not
really saying that this was not a jury issue.
I understand.
I'm saying that that it was their burden to make it so and to submit it to the jury, and they did not do that. We have been denied the right of trial by jury. There's just no way to get around it.
Counsel, you said there were two things the trial court decided as a matter of law.
Well, the other thing is,
one of them was alter ego. What's the other?
The other one is on the issue of disclosure to these people. They are claiming that they're claiming that we did not disclose to them that TDN would take them from Brownsville to Mexico. Now the evidence on that is, one, that this agency really, this so-called agency, if there was any, didn't begin until they got to Brownsville. It was Trailways that took them from Corpus to Brownsville. Trailways wasn't acting as an agent for TDN or anybody else. It was when they got to Brownsville that they were put on the Mexican bus. The evidence is that in Brownsville they got off of the bus that they were on, the Trailways bus. They went in the bus station. They turned in the ticket or coupon they'd been given by Trailways. They were issued another ticket on TDN. It was in Spanish. And eventually they were put on another bus and photographs of it are in the evidence that had Transportes del Norte all across it, in bold letters. And the cases say that any facts that will put the party on notice of disclosure are admissible and considered facts to support disclosure. We say, again, that this should have gone to the jury. And we asked the court for an issue on this question. Was it disclosed to them in Brownsville that they were going to be riding on Transportes de Minorti? And in fact, the plaintiffs asked for an issue. Denied. I'm going to decide this myself. So that's the other way we were denied the right of trial by jury, Your Honor. And both of those are crucial issues for Trailways, because particularly the one on the corporate separateness, that's a reverse and render point, we think. I mean, since they've not pled or proved or asked for a jury issue, one would think this court should reverse the judgment of the trial court and render a take-nothing judgment for Trailways. The issue on undisclosed principle, perhaps that should be returned to the... We did have a point of error in the Court of Appeals. One, there was no evidence of disclosure. Two, there was insufficient evidence of disclosure. And we have asked this court in an alternative prayer to remand to the Court of Appeals to decide that issue if the court feels there is some evidence on that, which I don't think there is. And they did not ask... They asked for a jury issue, but have not complained of the trial court's failure to submit it, and it was their burden to do so. I think that pretty well covers the very encapsulated form the points that I wanted to cover. I would like to say this, Judge Spears. It seems to me that although there is certainly some analogy to the motion in limine and the motion for sanctions, I think there's one difference, and that is that the opinions of this court on these motions for sanctions, several of them say the sanctions shall be automatic, whereas the motion in limine is considered simply a running type of thing, where it's not a final decision by the court. This was a final decision by Judge Garza. I'm going to let this person testify. The whole purpose of objections is to give the trial court an opportunity to make a correct ruling in this trial court.
Or to change his mind. Or to change his mind when he's ruled on a pretrial motion.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. But we feel like when the court, with the importance that the opinions of this court have put on sanctions and the statement that they are automatic upon the violation of the rule that the sanctions are automatic upon motion, we don't feel that we should be required to have kept objecting every time one of these witnesses start testifying. And there's no case that says we do. None of these cases require an objection. Now, whether those were in the record or not, I do not know. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I thought that where it was granted on just points 1 through 7, the points that were basically addressed by the respondents addressed issues that were... I recognize that, Your Honor, but I would also point out that under this court's Archuleta decision in 1984, it was an opinion by Judge Campbell, it was a workers' comp insurer type of case, that the court held that it could go back and look at the Court of Appeals points under McElvey versus Barber, but one of the things that had to be considered was that if the points that were being urged here in response, without any kind of points of error being filed or application being filed, if those points, if sustained, would lead to a different judgment than what was rendered by the Court of Appeals, in this case, rendition as opposed to reversal, that those points were waived. A procedural analogy occurred just like this case in Archuleta. The court went back, looked at the whole case, the points that had been preserved, those points that had not been brought forward, the court held were waived. I believe that's in volume 667.
By a separate application for the variance.
Yes, Your Honor. The respondents have made the statement that they received an unfair trial. In response to that, I would say that the rules do not permit games, and if they started the game in giving us a useless copy of the report, which is exhibit number 9 to the Rodriguez deposition. Yet they complained about an unfair trial, and they have sat here and accused us essentially of paying for testimony, which in many dictionaries amounts to bribery. They have accused us on brief of hiding the witness. They have accused basically the trial court of getting an unfair trial. But where in the record or anywhere is there support for this accusation? It's not there. And I would submit.
Counsel says that you never did supplement the answer.
Is Your Honor, we did supplement. We stated. I'm sorry.
When was it? When you actually filed the supplement.
It was a week before trial, Your Honor. I can't tell you the exact day. But it was approximately a week before trial, a week after the witness had been found, and we did so in substantial compliance with Rule 168, which allows reference to a document. In this case, it was one document. I would point out
tell me now, when did you first tell counsel the name and address of this witness that you had found?
Specifically saying that it is Mr. Hector Lira Morales, I believe it was on the day of the deposition.
In what period of time did you know that he was going to be called as a witness and you didn't tell him about it prior to that deposition? How much time elapsed there?
Just a few days. Some of this is on the record and some of it is outside the record, Your Honor.
But you filed with the court. You said a week before trial, the interrogatory.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you send it by slow mail, Mr. Garza, or how come he didn't find out about it when it was filed with the court?
The answer to the interrogatory, the supplemental response, said, see Javier Plasencia Exhibit Number 9.
And that has 50 exhibits, or 50 pages in?
Approximately, yes, Your Honor. But at the time, what we had was an illegible copy. What's in the record, first off, is that Sylvia Morris, the investigator in Mexico, spoke little English, if any. Ms. Garrow speaks no English. She's in the center of Mexico, in Querétaro, where she's finally found going various ways. She was looking for somebody. She was looking for a witness, anybody. The accident, the driver was killed.
We can characterize this by saying that you say you complied with the request for an interrogatory of the fact of witness by saying the name is found somewhere in this 50-page exhibit. Is that about the size of it?
In short answer, yes, Your Honor, but the report was signed by him. The interrogatories asked about what first was an investigation done and what were the names of the persons that did the investigation. That information is in there.
Name and address.
Name and address. Those things are in there, Your Honor, in the report.
His name and address is in the report.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was he the only investigating officer?
At the scene was Mr. Lira, TDN people. The report itself had conclusions that were made by his superiors. There may have been one other officer at the scene. I know for a fact that Mr. Lira was there. The conclusions about speed and whatnot were attached to that by his superiors. As far as Mr. Lira supposedly testifying outside of the report, I would point out first that he testified from his report about what he saw. He also explains why he didn't discuss the speed and violations in his report. This was discussed in the conclusiones that were attached. The driver was dead. He explained that the driver was dead. The report puts them on notice about this, Your Honor. It says that he had had the driver live, infractions of the type testified to at trial would have been made. He would have been charged with infractions. He would have been jailed. He was dead, and he just basically said, as Mr. Garza stated to the court that the driver was dead, and they don't go any further than that. One of the things that he noticed in the report were his braking distances. About on the basis that speed was the issue of speed was ultimately discussed at trial. All of this is part and parcel of exhibit number 9. Going back to the to the question about did we notify them about Hector Lira Morales, implied in that question is did we know it was Hector Lira Morales? In the United States, in Corpus Christi, we had an unusable copy. We have an investigator that a communications barrier. There is a communications barrier. And we were not notified that it was Hector Lira Morales. It was the investigator of the report. We don't have a clean copy of the report to go through all 50 pages and pull out this information in better answer to the interrogatories. We didn't have that.
When the deposition was taken in 1981, and you saw that they had a clean copy of the report, did you ask for it?
We didn't know that they had a clean copy of the report. That was ultimately tendered at trial and during the deposition of Mr. Morales. So we didn't know that what they had in their files was a clean, usable copy. All we had was what was tendered at the time of the deposition. We hardly knew what it was. In retrospect, in 2020 hindsight, perhaps counsel that had the case at the time should have pursued it further and asked them exactly what it was that was illegible. That's 2020 hindsight, Your Honor. I believe that the type of arguments that have been made, at least in the Court of Appeals and in brief, and by implication here, is that we are at fault for not discovering Lira sooner. And I think that in the end, this is a red herring argument, but in many ways underscores the minefields created by the technical requirements imposed by HEB versus Morrow and E.F. Hutton. I think it is, stripped of all rhetoric, a gotcha type of argument. In response to the subpoena deuces taken, they provided an unusable copy of the report, and yet they complained that we didn't pursue it, even though we hardly knew what it was, that we didn't translate it. We couldn't even read it in the first place to translate it.
What was in that exhibit that helped me? There's nothing else to speak. So how, you know, if you had a legible copy, how would you...
We would have found Hector Lira Morales 8 years earlier.
How so?
By knowing that he was the investigating officer.
You did not know that from the exhibit?
No, Your Honor, but the exhibit that was given to us in deposition is not the same one that was introduced at trial ultimately. It was an unusable copy. Judge Garza had seen that copy. Mosquero took it to the bench. There was some reference that the hearing only lasted 4 pages, but...
Okay, let me see if I narrowed it. We were in on this point. Is it the fact that you could not find them, or you could not read his name and address? And that, how did you have?
We didn't know who it was. We had no idea who it was.
Did you have a name and an address?
No, one. We had nothing to go on. The Mexican investigator, Sylvia Morris, was hired to find anybody, somebody, a witness, one of the survivors of the accident, to find somebody. Ultimately, through going through, I believe it was a godfather, a friend of a godfather, that kind of thing, had found the name of Mr. Lira and where he was since located. He moved. The record does show that he moved several times around Mexico.
Was all this investigation independent of the illegible copy that you perceived in the report?
Yes.
None of it was. The fact that you found the witness did not root back to the copy of the...
No, Your Honor. We found him in spite.
Independently.
In spite of it, independently.
You got this illegible copy years before.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you make a motion for a more legible copy?
No, Your Honor. We didn't know what it was, basically.
You asked for investigative reports and got them?
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't know that it was investigative reports?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was this investigative report filed in the records in Mexico? Was it an official document?
It was an official document, yes, Your Honor, but I don't believe that it was available.
Okay. And finally, given all this, why didn't trial counsel move or expressly file a motion asking him for a good cause, asking to show good cause for the late supplementation?
I think this goes back to the time when the case was tried. September 1986. This court had just come down with its opinion in HEB versus Morrow in July 16th, but did not rule on the rehearing until after this case had been tried. So okay. It wasn't in the books.
Okay. There was a new opinion. Was there a new opinion on rehearing? I mean, it was in the Texas Supreme Court Journal, but
yes,
not
sir.
In West.
Yes.
You told us of the 50-page report. Now, the 50-page report was all illegible?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was shown to Judge Carson. That was taken up to the bench, and it was shown to him that it was useless.
Was it? Could you determine on the basis of your examination of it who prepared it?
No, Your Honor.
For what agency or group it was prepared?
No, Your Honor.
Did you question the other counsel about it since they were furnishing it?
No, Your Honor. At this point, we're dealing with different trial. There was another lead counsel that was involved that eventually turned over the case to Mascaro.
But there was no question by the counsel for the plaintiff in regard to identifying this report as to where it came from, who authenticated it, for what purpose it was prepared.
No, that is not in the record. That is not in the record, and I would have to say, since it's not in the record, that for purposes of the appeal, the answer is no.
But what you saw a legible copy in the hands of the counsel for the other side, did you determine that it was a police report?
Yes, Your Honor. At that point, we knew that.
Was it prepared for the police department?
For the Mexican Federal Police.
For the Mexican Federal
and the,
Police?
And the prosecutor.
It was prepared for the bus company?
No, Your Honor. They participated in the investigation.
And I assume even their legible copy was a copy. Was it somewhere else the original report was filed?
Correct.
And is it a matter of record where that report was filed?
No, Your Honor. I don't know exactly where it was filed. I know that Mr. Lira himself couldn't get a copy of it. I think one of the explanations that might be made at this point was that after the wreck and before trial, that besides Mr. Lira moving around, there's also a period of time in which Mexico was hit with earthquake. And even if there had been addresses in there of witnesses, those places, those streets didn't even exist.
Was Mr. Lira, at the time of the investigation, a Mexican federal police officer?
Yes, sir. And
it was his job to prepare an investigation report of the accident.
Correct.
And turn it into his to his office, to his superior.
Yes, sir. And from that, the superiors added their conclusions to that, and that was attached. That's part of the 50 pages. Now, that wasn't the conclusions themselves were not admitted at trial.
When you judge finally located that. Him, was he still a Mexican police officer?
Yes, Your Honor. He was still working for the Mexican police.
I'm looking at a copy which is in volume 10 of the statement of fact, and it is addressed to the federal police and gives a specific address. And I do not speak Spanish, but I can tell that part of it is labeled investigation and determinant of causation. And at the end, it has commentaries. And I took Spanish in high school, so it's very rudimentary. But you couldn't read any of this information from the copy that you were given?
No, Your Honor.
I had asked earlier when you supplemented your answer to the interrogatory by referencing the exhibit, whether the address of the witness was in the exhibit, and I understood your answer to be yes. Then I understood you to say later that the witness had moved several times. So my question to you again is, at the time that the answer was supplemented, did the exhibit disclose the address of the witness, Mr. Lee?
Not his address. It did identify the office that he was with, the agency.
The federal agency or the specific location of the office?
The federal agency.
Was that legible in the report that you had?
No, Your Honor.
It was only found out when you got the one that was eligible.
Right. Well, I just want to make the statement so that everything is perfectly clear that we did not find Lara because of the report that was given us. We found it in spite of it. We had the investigator out there that found out who the investigator was and found him.
Okay, and when you ultimately found him, I guess he told you he had made a report.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the business of the court for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.